This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The other apology that I've got for this evening is that we've learned and recently again in the delightful Kuzari Shiur that takes place every Monday morning over breakfast at the beach,
right.
Every Friday morning over breakfast at the beach, that one truly only values things after one no longer has them. That's just one of the tragedies of life, that as much as we try to value what we have, we really only value what we no longer have. And part of the purpose of Bracha, Sikseima Bracha, is to try and simulate what life would be without the thing that you're about to enjoy, so that one can fully appreciate it. And that's the only way you can get to a complete valuing of something, is to actually stop yourself and say, what would things be like if I didn't have this? And really put yourself into that frame of mind. That's the way one can value and appreciate things. And Elisa Weiss is our usual organizer, and it's only when she's not here that we realize some of the things that go wrong. And one of the things is our Xeroxes are not fully up to date. We've got the beginning of chapter 3, but I'm going to go right into chapter 3. I have to complete chapter 3 this evening, so you're not going to have a text in front of you. So I will read through the text and explain it, but you won't have it in front of you, unfortunately, as we do that. We learned last week about the game that turned into tragedy. It was quite interesting. I was discussing the shiur with my daughter, who wasn't at the shiur, and we were talking about the fact that last week we were discussing games turning into tragedy and young boys killing each other over that. And she said, yeah, but how did you wrangle that into the shiur? It just happened to be something. And I said, that's one of the most amazing things, is that in teaching Torah, one sees God's hands in a number of different ways, and one of the ways is the unbelievable coincidence, not in the normal sense of the word, but in the literal sense of the word, of two incidents happening simultaneously, of finding oneself in a particular passage that is particularly appropriate. And that's why we put so much emphasis on discussing the parsha of the week. Not just because that's what we happen to be reading about, but because the fact is that the way God works the world, the lessons we need for that week are in that week's parsha. When a child is born, often we'll take a name out of that parsha. It's not coincidental. That's the way God operates, that He gives us the blueprints we need for that time. When the thing is happening around a yontif, the learning, the teachings of that yontif are particularly relevant to dealing with the issues that face us at those particular times of the year. So it's not just a question of homiletics, it's actually the way the world is programmed. And it was therefore quite unusual that last week we learned the only example in the whole of the Tanakh of games turning into violence, of play turning into deathly violence, and the serious results of that, the death of Asael, the brother of Yoav, the general of David. So again, Avner, the general of Shaul, of the late Shaul, Avner has, based on his understanding of a verse in Bereshis, established Ishbosheth, the son of Shaul, as king over the vast majority of Israel. David remains king only over his own tribe, Yehuda. He has Yoav, his general, at his right hand. And Asael, Yoav's brother, was killed in the pursuit of Avner. And now we continue that story in the beginning of chapter 3, which is on page 729. Vatehi amelchomo arucho bein beis Shaul uvein beis David. And the war was extended between the house of Shaul and the house of David. The David holech vechozek. And David was getting continuously stronger. And the house of Shaul was continually weakening over this period of time. David was living in Hebron. His family began to grow. He had sons. His firstborn was Amnon, the son of Ahinoam. The second was Chilov, born to Abigail, the wife of Nobal, you remember, that Nobal died, and his wife David married his wife. They had a son, Chilov. And the Gemara has some interesting things to say about him, why his name was Chilov, when elsewhere we find his name recorded as Daniel. Why he's called Chilov here? And the one is that Chilov means he looks like the father. There were rumors that Chilov was in fact the son of Nobal. He married Abigail very soon after the death of Nobal, and there were rumors that he was the son of Nobal. And God did to him as he had done in previous cases when such rumors emerged, and made him physically very similar in appearance to David, to his own father, so that there should be absolute clarity about his... They didn't have DNA tests in those days, but where the physical appearance was very similar, it was clearly genetic, and there was an acceptance that he was in fact David's son. You see the level of mischief-making, the level of people's desire to undermine, to devalue one another, and God's response to that. That's the one reason that he's called Chilov. And the other is, Rabbi Seinu Amrush says, Rashi Shoyo Machlin Penein Mefivoshes Bahalocha. That it comes from the word Machlin, to shame. That he could put Mefivoshet to shame in learning. Mefivoshet was David's Rebbe. David's teacher was Mefivoshet. And David's son Chilov was such a Talmud Chochem that he could put David's teacher to shame in a battle of wits over learning. So he was a great man. Ba'ashlishi, and the third one was Avshalom ben Maacha, Bat Talmai Melech Geshur. David married Maacha, who was a princess, daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur, and their son was Avshalom. And Avshalom, of course, was still going to have a lot of interesting interaction with Avshalom. Caused David a great deal of heartache later on in the story. Baharavi, the fourth one was Adonio ben Chanis. Bahamishi Shaftio ben Avito. Fourth one was Adonia. The fifth one was Shvatia. Bahashishi, the sixth one was Yisrom. Le Eglo, Ashis David, born to Eglo, the wife of David. Ele Yudu, Le David, Bechevron. These all were born to David in Hebron. Verse 6, and it was as the war, the battle between the house of Saul and the house of David became more intense, the Avner hayo mischazek beveis Shaul, and Avner was becoming stronger in the household of Shaul. So although the household of Shaul's overall power was in decline, Avner's personal power was on the incline. When the Shaul pilege shushmo ritzpo vasayo, and Shaul had a concubine, and her name was Ritzpah of Asayo. A concubine in those days didn't mean a mistress. A concubine was almost the status of a wife. There were some technical differences, some technical halachic differences in terms of financial responsibilities after separation. They could separate more easily than a wife. There wasn't need for a get, there wasn't need for a formal divorce, and there were no financial obligations after the relationship. But while the relationship existed, the responsibilities were the same as those of a wife. So Shaul had a pilegesh, her name was Ritzvah, by Yemer of Avner, and he said to Avner, he being probably Ishbosheth, Shaul's son, Madua Boso Pilegesh Ovi, he throws out an accusation at him, and says, why were you intimate with my father's pilegesh, with my father's concubine? What's Avner's reaction? Vayichal Avner Moed. Avner gets incredibly angry at Ishbosheth's words, and he says, Harosh Kelev Anochi? Do you think I'm a dog tender? Am I the god of the dogs? I would rather be doing goodness to the house of Yehuda, to David's house, than to your house, if this is how you treat me. Do you think I would be taking care of your father's family, your father's household, and not handing you over to David, which I would have had the power to do? And after this kindness, you accuse me of this foul deed? Ko If so may God do to Avner, to himself, as God has in fact sworn to David, I will help David achieve that which God swore to him. If you have accused me of this deed, I declare from here on I will assist David in taking the kingdom from your father. And to establish the throne of David on the Jewish people, not only on Yehuda but on the whole of Israel. From Dan in the north all the way down to Beersheba, I will assist David to overcome the entire kingdom. And Ishbosheth was so taken by the fury in Avner that he couldn't continue the discussion. That was the end of the discussion. But Avner put his words into action. Avner sent messengers to David. Very interesting phrase, and I'm sorry we don't have it in front of you. Let me read it to you. Vayishlach Avner malochim el David tachtov lemer. And Avner sent messengers to David beneath him, saying, what does tachtov mean? What does it mean beneath him? It's a strange use of the word. Rashi explains, Shmoy hizkir tchilo b'igeris, b'achar kach hizkir shem David. He put his name first in the letter. He sent a letter with the messengers, and he put in his name first, reading, like you do with a mimo nowadays. How do we address a mimo? We say to so-and-so, from so-and-so, isn't that right? Which is the correct way to do it. A mimo. A memo, you say memos. No, very good. I mean, you say memos too. I thought you say memos. But you do know what I mean. You say to and then from. That's the correct way. He did it the other way around. From Avner, the general, to the king.
That's what he addresses the letter. You put your name in the capital letter, and then you put foods to the Lord.
Interesting, you're right. But the sending to a king, you put the king first. To his majesty the king, from his humble servant so and so. But Avner put his own name first, and Rashi adds two words, and remember them for later on in the chapter, Ulekach Me'enash, and that's why he was punished. So something happens to Avner, and we have a bit of a battle trying to work out what he's punished for. What did he really do so wrong? And Rashi introducing here an arrogance in his relationship to David. And what does he say to David? I say in the name of the Mi Oretz to he who owns the land, saying, Koso brischoiti, make your covenant with me. Vehine yodi imoch, and my hand will be with you. Lo save elecho es kol Yisrael. I will deliver to you the whole of Israel. There's an arrogance in placing himself first, but there's also a touch of arrogance in the part he wishes to play in making David king. God has already made David king. Avner comes along and says, I will deliver the people to you, which would mean your kingdom will then be forever indebted to me, which means that he will be the power behind the throne. And that's dangerous. That wouldn't be good. But how does David react? David says, very good. I'm happy. We'll have peace in the land. We'll have one kingdom. I'll do a deal with you. But there's one thing I ask of you, and this is conditional. The whole deal is conditional to this thing. You will not see me unless you come with Michal, the daughter of Shaul. Who is Michal, the daughter of Shaul? Supposed to be his wife, but she was given in chapter 25 of Shmuel Aleph. Shaul gave her to Palti, and that was quite a controversial issue as to what exactly happened there. It was promised to David. Did David marry her? How did she land up in the hand of Palti? But she was in Palti's hand, and David says, now's the time. If you want to show your loyalty to me, bring me my wife, bring me Michal. Vayishlach David malochim al Ishbosheth ben Shaul emer. And David then sent messengers to Ishbosheth, the son of Shaul, the king of the rest of Israel, saying, "Tanois ishti es Michal asher erasti li b'mei olus kishti. I want my wife, Michal, who I betrothed." So we see there was an erusin. Those of you who learned in the Gemara tradition before, you understand exactly what that means. There was a betrothal. There was a wedding that took place. between him and Michal. And what he invested in her was the 100 foreskins of the Plishtim. In other words, the 100 Plishtim that he killed, the Philistines that he killed, for Shaul. Vayishlach Ishbosheth vayikocheo me'im ish. And Ishbosheth, realizing he's lost Avner's loyalty, and without Avner he's nothing. And you see the kind of man Avner is. So Avner was loyal to Shaul all these years, but now is his chance to be kingmaker. He made Ishbosheth king, and the moment Ishbosheth showed some kind of assertiveness and accused him of having had a relationship with his father's Pelegish, and we don't know whether he did or he didn't, but the mere accusation brings Avner to the realization, this man is no longer going to feel indebted to me. And he leaves Ishbosheth and does a deal with David. So Ishbosheth has now lost his base, and he responds to David. And Ishbosheth takes Michal, Me'im Paltiel ben Laish, from Paltiel ben Laish, who is her husband. Vayelech ito isho, and her husband went with her. Haloich uvochri achareho, walking and crying behind her. Ad Bachurim, until the point of Bachurim. Vayeme Erev Avner lech shuv. And at that point Avner said to Paltiel, Gam, Vayoshuv, and he went. Strange story. The words of Avner came to the elders of Israel saying, just a little while ago you were trying to destroy David. You wanted to establish King David as king over you, but Ata also, now you can do that. Because God has said to David that he will be the king, so this is Avner going to the rest of Israel and selling to them the concept of a unified kingdom. Avner then went to Binyamin, and he went to speak to all of them, and then he went to David in Hebron. Vayomer Avner and David Hebron, he came to David, together with 20 men. Vayas David l'Avner anoshim ashito mishto. David entertains them, he makes a party for Avner and his 20 men. David, and Avner said to David, I can deliver to you the entire nation of Israel, and they will make a deal with you, you will then rule over the entire nation. And David agrees, they have the party, and he sends Avner off in peace and good spirit. Yoav comes back from a battle with the Plishtim. Now Yoav, of course, is going to be a little concerned that he's going to be displaced by Avner. Yoav has been able to establish David as king over Yehuda, but Avner has delivered the rest of the nation into the hands of David. So Yoav, as second in command, as the general, is going to be second fiddle to Avner. And they all came, and Yoav was told, saying, Avner came to the king, and the king did a deal with him. Avner went away with a smile on his face, looking very snug. Yoav came to the king by Yomer, and he said, Me'asisa, what have you done? Hinevo Avner alecho, lomo ze shilachto vayelech aloich. Avner came to you to do a deal. Are you telling us that you did the deal with him? You made him feel okay? You know that Avner came just to seduce you and to know your comings and goings. You know that he's a sly man. You didn't really trust him, did you? Yoav didn't even wait for an answer. He walked off, sent messengers to Avner, and called him back without David knowing. So Yoav now takes the law into his own hands, calls Avner, brings Avner, very interesting sentence, Vayoshev Avner Hebron, Vayateyu Yoav Otoy Hashar, and Yoav persuades him to come with him to the gate. The gate is a phrase used in the Torah many times to connotate the law courts, because they used to be at the gates of the city, the Sanhedrin. So, two views. The one is, he pretended to be taking him to the law courts, and the other is, he in fact took him to the law courts. Over what? What's the issue? You killed my brother. You're a murderer. So he lays a charge of murder against Avner. Or he establishes intention to do so. All we're told there afterwards is, Mayakehu Shom HaChomesh. He hit him there, he stabbed him in his fifth rib, by Yomos Bedam Asoel Lochiv, and he died because of the blood of Asoel, Yoav's brother. What was that interaction? According to the view that he actually went to the Sanhedrin, what was the debate? What was the argument? The argument was, you killed Asoel. The defense was, Asoel was pursuing me, and I asked him to stop. And the law is that if one is pursued, and you can save yourself only by killing the pursuer, you're permitted to do so, self-defense. Very important law. Yoav says that you could have saved yourself by going for another limb. You could have got his leg. He was running after you. You didn't have a motorcycle. You could have shot him in the leg. Why did you kill him? So that soul I couldn't aim. Tried to, couldn't aim. Says Yoav, taking his spear and hitting Avner in the fifth rib, you knew exactly where to hit. The fifth rib is the fatal one. And that's where you pierced him. Don't say you couldn't aim. You aimed very well. And kills him there with the permission of the Sanhedrin. Or, according to others, he nearly got Avner on the pretext of going to the law courts, but in fact took the law into his own hands and killed him outside the law courts. Now, let us think for a moment, what position does this put David in? So David is in a situation where he commands only Yehuda. He has just been delivered the rest of the state by Avner, who is a hero in the rest of the state. Avner has just been assassinated by David's army general. Look at the potential now for the civil war. We've really got everything hot and ready for the civil war, and here we'll test the skills of this young king. David is in his 30s, a young man, inexperienced in the art of ruling, and here is his first major crisis, a potential civil war. David heard so, and the first thing he said is, Noki anochi mamlachti me'in Hashem ad olam. My kingdom and I have no responsibility in this act. In that implication is also, therefore Yoav has the responsibility. This act was illegal, is the first thing you say. Not only was it not directed by us, but the act was illegal. Yochulu al rosh Yoav al kol beis aviv. May they descend upon the head of Yoav and all the house of his father a curse. May at all times there be present in the household of Yoav Zov, impure people, sick people, Metzorah, people with leprosy, the Machzik Papelech, people on crutches, the Mefel Bacherev, and people who die in war. Terrible curse, and we'll discuss that curse. The Chosar Lechem, and people without food, may there be poverty in his household. He curses the descendants of Yoav. We're going to have to look at that. Why curse the descendants? What did they do wrong? And Yoav and Avishai, his brother, killed Avner because he had killed Asor, the brother in the given, Bemilchama, in war, says David. Bear in mind that it is true that Avner committed a murder, but he committed a murder in the heat of the battle. What Yoav did was not in the heat of battle. Yoav did this while we were trying to establish peace. And David then instructs the entire nation to go into mourning, to tear their clothes, to wear sackcloth, to eulogize. Va'melech David helech achrei amito, and the king himself walked behind the body at the funeral. He went to the funeral, he walked right behind the body. Although the law is a king doesn't go to funerals, this funeral he went to. They buried him in Hebron. The king cried about Avner, and so did the nation. And the king eulogized Avner, and this eulogy is going to be important for us to analyze. Hakamos novo yomus Avner. Has Avner died just like a degraded person, without any heroism even? Your hands were not bound, nor were your legs bound up. And yet you have fallen before these criminals. And the people continued to cry. The people came to David to visit him, that's like, just like a shiva house. He came to comfort him. And David said, I will eat nothing. They brought him food. He said, until nightfall, I will eat nothing. I'm fasting. The cholam hikiru. And the nation recognized that David was sincere, that he had no part in this murder. Vayitav b'enehim, they accepted it. Vayedu cholam v'chol Yisrael b'yom ha'ru. The whole nation and all of Israel knew that day, ki lo hirso ma'amelech le'emis es Avner b'meir, that the murder of Avner ben Ner did not emanate from the king. And the king said to his servants, you should know, Kisar Gadol Nafal Hayom Hazeh b'Yisrael, a great prince, a great officer has fallen this day in Israel. V'anuchi Hayom Rach u'Meshuach Melech, and I today am young, immature, undeveloped, and anointed as king. V'anashim ha'ele b'nei Tzruya, but these men, the sons of Tzruya, Yoav and Avishai, Koshim mimeni, they're tougher than I. May God pay the dues of this evil. That's how David reacts, with honest and sincere regret and mourning and remorse, so that there could be no question in the eyes of the people that there was sincerity, that David had no part in this murder, but his intention was to make peace with Avner and to build a common land. Now there are a few things we're going to go into in this chapter. The main issues that we're going to look at is the whole story with Avner, why he was killed, was it right that he was killed, both from a moral perspective and from a legal perspective. And the other issue is in relation to Michal, this wife of David, and Paltiel, her husband. Before we get on to the Avner question, we're going to deal with the Michal question and with one other, because both of them illustrate a point that, and this might be the only section of the shul we're able to complete this evening, and the balance of it will have to be next week. And that is some degree of understanding of the power of what we term the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is commonly translated as the evil inclination. But it's something much more powerful than that. And the mechanisms we have to deal with it. First, related to this chapter, there's a discussion in the Gemara that we'll have a look at, and that is a halakhic discussion, nothing to do with the chapter, but the Gemara uses this chapter as a source to determine the law. The issue the Gemara is discussing is, it would seem a pretty petty one, but it has some interesting significance. And that is, at a funeral, should women walk in front of the casket or behind it? What difference would it make? Gemara says in Sanhedrin Daf Chaf, we learnt, Makum shenagu noshim lotzes, achar hamita yotzus, lifnei hamita yotzus. Women want to, if the custom is that they, in that particular place, that they walk ahead of the casket, that's fine. The custom is that they walk behind, that's fine also, whatever the custom is. Rabbi Yehuda says, lo'elom noshim lifnei hamita yotzus. The women should always walk in front of the casket. So imagine, picture a funeral, you've got women leading the way, then the dead person, and then the men. Why? What is the reason for the women to walk in front? What is the reason for them to walk behind? The reason for them to walk behind, says Tosfos, is lefi shegnai livnos Yisrael sheistaklu bahem anoshim. And I'm going to try and explain the sensitivity of this. What the Tosfos says is, it is humiliating for women to be stared at by men. Now, in our society, it might not be that easily understood, because sometimes women find it quite a compliment. But that's not necessarily saying a great deal about our society. Because when men do stare sensually at women, they're not admiring the women for anything that those women have really achieved of themselves. They're admiring them for the lowest common denominator of what they are. their beauty, their attractiveness. And sure, that's something real, it's something great, it's something wonderful. But why would Tosfot say she deny her? For the women to walk in front and the men behind, and the women to sense that the men are staring at them from behind, it's humiliating. The reason is not because of the sanctity of the men and all that they be worried about. We're worried about the dignity of the women. So whereas in secular society it's ladies first, in religious society it's very often men first, for this reason. But the woman doesn't know who's looking at her and how they're looking at her from behind and what they're thinking and what faces they're making to each other from behind. It's just a gnaihula. So the fact that in our society those women do take some kind of pleasure in that and feel attractive is quite pathetic in a sense. Because what the women should feel attractive about and admired for are things that you can't just see from the distance, and things that differentiate her, the things she's made of herself, the person she's made of herself, the character she has developed within herself, the intelligence she's developed herself, the personality she's developed, the achievement she's made. That's the way men look at each other. Why should men not look at women the same way? The answer is because there's a whole biological and sexual dynamic that takes place, but that's not elevating for the woman, or ought not to be elevating for the woman. And to protect the woman, we would say to the women, stand at the back. So part of the whole separation issue, mechitza in shul, separation in a shul, there are many reasons of it. Part of the reasons is not to distract the men, but another reason is that a woman in shul doesn't want to spend a moment thinking that she's being looked at in that kind of sense, like some kind of a capital marketplace. And that's what shuls become. The men go to shuls to look at women and to find women. The young men go to shuls to find. That's okay to meet afterwards, but during the davening, a woman should be protected from that sense during the time that she's davening. And that's why it's quite interesting. You'll often find that the men say, you know, the mechitza shouldn't be so high, and one would expect the women to say, yeah, sure, we don't want the mechitza. Well, you have feminists who say, we don't want the mechitza, take it away. The men can sit there, we want to sit next to the men, we want to sit next to the husband. You get that element. But if you get rid of that and you talk to people who understand and who're sensitive, very often the women say, we want the mechitza. We feel more comfortable behind the mechitza. And one has to be alert to that, that the purpose of the mechitza is not just to protect the spiritual purity of the men's minds. That's only one part of it. An equally important part, as we see here, is to protect the dignity of the women. But if the men were such tzaddikim that we could trust to the fact that they would have their noses in their sidurim, it wouldn't be so serious. But we don't trust that, and the woman doesn't know, and therefore she doesn't want to be there with that sense of what's going on. And she's looking, and the men are talking to one another and pointing up at the women in the gallery or across the mechitza, and each woman doesn't know what they're saying. It's just an unpleasant feeling. It's unnecessary. And that's part of the reason for that mechitza. Now, if that's the case, then it would be very clear the women should be at the back in the funeral line. Why is there even a sense that they should be at the front? What is the view that puts them ahead of the dead body? The reason for that is because aesthetically that's proper. Why? Because women caused death in the world. Caused death. It was with Eve. Eve and the snake. If that wouldn't have happened, then there wouldn't have been death. When did God introduce death? God gave Adam the law, don't eat from the tree. The snake came along, seduced Eve into eating from the tree. She seduced her husband into eating from the tree. The consequence was death. So it was, in fact, and those of you who have learned that piece of Chumash with me will remember also the sensuality in that, both in the relationship between the snake and Eve, and between Eve and Adam. But it was, in fact, that whole attractiveness of women that caused death to be the consequence, or the end point of life. And therefore, at a funeral, from an aesthetic point of view, when you look at the structure of it, the women leading the person to their burial place has a certain poetic correctness to it. It reminds people where it all comes from. When people look at it and say, that's strange, women in the front, it's not normally that way. Normally in a shul, whenever we get together, the women are at the back, and that makes sense. Why are the women in the front? It brings one to realize the whole thing, that it was because of the attractiveness, as great as that attractiveness is, and as essential as it is, and God put it there, as holy as it is, that attractiveness also has the capacity to bring about death. It can also bring about destruction. And there's an awareness of that duality, that power, that as great it is, and we find that throughout the Torah, when something is enormously constructively powerful, it has the same enormity of potential destructive effect. If nuclear power can, one single atom can provide energy for an enormous city, one single atom can destroy an enormous city. It works like that in all areas, in the spiritual areas too. When something is extremely powerful, the power can be directed either constructively or destructively. And it's important to recognize that in male-female relationships. That as constructive and beautiful and powerful as it is to be constructive, so it also was responsible for the breakdown of that relationship between man and God in the first stage that led ultimately to death. The Gemara then comes to the conclusion, to the initial attempt at a conclusion, that it must be that the women go ahead of the dead body. Why? Because it says in our chapter, HaMelech David, HaMelech Achara Mitzah, that the king went behind the dead body. And certainly he wouldn't have been at a funeral, there would have been some kind of separation. If the king was behind, surely he would have been with the men, not with the women. So we must assume that the women were walking in front. Now says the Gemara, this funeral, David's role in this funeral was very unique. He was there not for the funeral, he was there for political reasons. He was there for networking. He was there to convince people that this was not, that he and his government had no part in this murder. That's why he was there. And he didn't stay only on the men's side. He intertwined. He went from the men to the women, and back to the men, and back to the women. Because at the end it says, after the funeral, all of the Jewish people, the entire nation, now knew that David was sincere. How did they know? The men, we understand. David was at the funeral. They talked to him. They saw him crying. But what about the women? If they were standing in front, they didn't see the king. Says the Gemara, he moved among the men and among the women. He went backwards and forwards. He wanted to interact with everybody present to make sure that everybody could see the depth of his despair and his sorrow at the death of Avner, so that there would be absolutely no question, not in the men's mind nor the women's mind, that that was his intention, that was his true feeling. So we can bring no proof from David's placement as to where the women were, because David was with the men and the women. Now, why I bring this Gemara in is not just because it draws on this particular chapter, but because it introduces us to the enormity of the power of the physical attraction between man and woman, and the mechanisms that the Torah inserts to protect both man and woman, both the dignity of man and woman, from that relationship and from that dynamic and from that power, which leads us into the second part of the Shir. Second part of the Shir concerns Paltiel. Now, there's a big problem with this. However we want to learn it, the story with Paltiel is quite difficult, because assuming David married Michal, which we assume happens, he says, I want to say to Mephibosheth, bring back Michal, whom I betrothed. Assuming he betrothed her, Shaul then took her away and gave her to Paltiel. Now, whether that was with a divorce from David or was not, there are different views. Some say that David did not divorce her, but that, well, we'll see what happened, how that worked if he didn't divorce her. Others say he did divorce her. Shaul insisted on a divorce from David. She now remarries Paltiel. There is a law that a divorcee who remarries can never remarry her first husband again. So if a man and a woman get divorced and later on they want to change their minds and get together again, that's fine, 100%, nothing wrong with that at all. But if she remarries in the meantime, then the first two can never get together again. And the reason for that is to discourage any kind of legitimate form of wife swapping. Like without marriage and divorce, people wouldn't have done it. But marriage and divorce is very simple in Jewish law. So at a swinging party, we can can you imagine a frum swinging party with a whole lot of Hasidim and ladies there with a sheitlach, and they decide, let's do some wife swapping. The answer is, Chas v'Shalom, how can we? We're married. We're married people. We can't do such a thing. So some bright spark would say, there's a way to do it kosher. We'll all divorce our wives, then we'll wife swap, and then we'll all divorce our second wives, and we'll get married to our first ones again. We'll have a good time, and it's all kosher. The ingenuity of the Jewish people. And God foresaw that possibility and said, no ways. You want to get divorced, that's fine. You want to marry somebody else, that's fine too. But then you need to know that you can't marry the first one again. That's over. That you can't do. So that's the law. That's the law of the Torah. In that case, Michal has married Palti. How can she now marry David again? That's the real issue. Even if it was all legitimate, there was a divorce and a remarriage, even if it was all legitimate, the fact is, she's married somebody else intimately. How can she remarry her first husband? Says the Medrash, at the end of Acharemus, Shlesho hem sheborchu min ha'avero. There are three people who fled from sin. Veshitef ha'kodesh boruchu shmoyim ahem, and God puts his name to theirs to declare that they didn't sin. They were him, these are they. Yosef, Yael, and Palti. Yosef, how do we know about Yosef? The case of Yosef was, he went to visit Potiphar's wife one fine day. He went to visit her on a day when he knew there was nobody else in the house, and she knew there was nobody else in the house. Who knows what happened? The Torah tells us what happened. Who says it's true? Maybe something did happen. Says God, Edus be Yosef Somer. I give evidence to Yosef, and in that word, the verse in Tehillim in Psalms, Yosef is spelt with a hey, with God's letter. It's not Yosef, it's Yehosef. God adds his name to Yosef's to declare that Yosef was not, that there was no sin. God, Meir Golov, gives evidence on him, Shalei Nogo Ba'eshus Potiphar, that he didn't touch the wife of Potiphar. Number one. Yael went out to meet Sisera, and it says, whom she eventually kills, Sisera, a wicked general, Batechaseu Bismicho, she attracts Sisera into her tent, and she puts him to sleep before she murders him. And it says she covered him with a blanket, a smicho. Ma'u smicho, what is a smicho? What is this word blanket? It says Reish Lakish Chazano Akol Amikro. We have gone through the entire Tanakh, every part of the whole Tanakh. The Lo Matzino Kli Sheshmo Smicho. We didn't find the word smicho. What does it mean? What does smicho mean? Says the Midrash Shmi Ko. My name is here. What does that mean? Shemi meyidolei shemei nogolei sorosha. I give evidence that wicked man had no contact with this woman, because there's no other way we could know. The case of Yosef, well, she was alone with Potiphar in the house. There was yichud. Nobody could know what happened. Yael and Sisera were alone. Only God was present. Nobody else could know. God says, I give evidence. Palti. Says the Medrash, very interesting. If you look in chapter 25, you'll see that it says Vishol Nosan es Michal Bitoi lePalti, that Shaul gave Michal to Palti. It says in the end of chapter 25. And in our chapter it says Paltiel. Palti plus another two letters of God's name. I give evidence that through the entire marriage he never touched her, that marriage was never consummated, that Palti never came near Michal. Two questions, leaving aside Sisera and Yael, because that was a different one. Sisera was a non-Jew and he was wicked, and Yael, that's one issue. But let's look at Yosef and at Paltiel, two people who had the opportunity. Both of them tzaddikim, both of them righteous people, both had the opportunity of intimacy with women they found incredibly attractive, but who were married to somebody else. What was the mechanism they used to retain the integrity of that relationship? Two completely different mechanisms. Let's look at Yosef. Some of you will be familiar with how Yosef did it. Yosef is a young boy in Egypt, and this powerful, attractive, dynamic, vivacious woman, the wife of Potiphar, has her eye on Yosef and makes it very clear that she's available. And Yosef works in the household. Batisra Adeno, Eshes Adeno, Esenao Yosef, she eyes him. Batayman, and eventually when he ignores her, she says quite clearly, Shichwa Yimi, have an affair with me. Quite openly. What does this young man do? He reasons with her. He says, you know, there's nobody in the house more senior than I. Only your husband. And he hasn't kept anything away from me except you. You're his wife. How could I do something so immoral to him? He says to her. And then he adds, and in addition to being immoral, the chotosi re'elokim, I will sin to God as well. Then he says for himself. So as far as you're concerned, wife of Potiphar, you don't believe in God, but you need to believe in basic morality. So it would be immoral. As far as I'm concerned, it would not only be immoral, it would also be a crime against God. So I'm not going to do that. So he has his morality very clear in his own mind. Doesn't listen to her. When the Torah told us an interesting thing, it was on a particular day. And he came to the house to do his work. There was no man of the men of the house there in the house. Very wordy phrase. There were no men of the men of the house there in the house. It was at that time that she grabs hold of him and tries to seduce him, and he takes off his jacket, leaves it in her hand, and flees outside the house. And that, of course, started quite a difficult time for Yosef. The question is, what was he doing in the house if there were no men? He knows she's after him. He knows she has authority. He knows she's attractive. And he knows there's nobody in the house. Everybody's away. Everybody's out for the day. Why is he there? On what basis does he go there? So there's two views, Rav and Shmuel. One says to do his work, he just had a job to do, so he went to do it. The Had Omar says Tzorochav Imo, and the other one says Yosef caved in. He was going to have an affair with her. So what happened to his argument about the morality to the husband and about the sinning to God? So he rationalized that some way. That's the power of the Yetzer Hara. When one wants something passionately enough, you find the justification, you find the way to make it okay. It's not immoral, and it isn't sinning to God. She's not Jewish, and who knows how he rationalized it. So what stopped him at the last minute? It says the Gemara in Sotah, it says there were no men of the men of the house there in the house, but there was someone else, not of the men of the house there in the house, and that was a sudden picture of the image of his father. What did that add? What could his father, the image of his father, have told him that he hadn't worked out? If he'd rationalized it, what did his father's face tell him? We spoke last week about the tradition that a parent hands down to a child. Not just the laws, the do's and don'ts, but a tradition. And part of the tradition is a simple sense of we don't do that. That's a phrase that one seldom hears nowadays. A phrase that a child doesn't question, because there's nothing to question. There's not a why don't we do that. It's in our family, we just don't do that. And that builds up the culture of a family. What differentiates that family? What makes that family noble? What makes that family fine? Just certain things that we don't do. It's not only a family, it should also be a nation. We as Jews, certain things we don't do. It should be a community that differentiates a community. Certain things we don't do. There tends to be in our society a reduction of everything to the lowest common denominator, so that no family doesn't do things that other families don't do. So that no religion doesn't do things that other religions don't do. That no community doesn't do things that others don't do. And notice I'm focusing on the negative, on the things we don't do, because that's culture. Culture is not what we do. What we do is not culture. What we do is tradition. But real culture are the things we just don't do. And we don't question it. These are just things that everybody understands that we don't do, because they're not nice. It's a question of taste. The role of the father is that when the child pictures the father's face, even though he's gone through all the rationalizations, he can see from his father's face that that's just something we don't do. Now, that is something I've often mentioned that I experience, not only with my own father, but with my Rosh Hashiva as well. He had a particular face that was about, when he used that face, it was the most humiliating experience imaginable. And he used it when we proposed an idea that he felt wasn't well thought out. And he wasn't going to argue it through. Sometimes you proposed an idea which was a good idea or a way of thinking, and he would argue it with you. And sometimes at the end of the argument, usually at the end of the argument, you would cave in. But sometimes at the end of the argument you wouldn't, and he would respect that. There were times when he would say to me, I don't agree, I wouldn't have got to that outcome, but I see how you're thinking, and that's fine. But sometimes he wouldn't even indulge in a debate. When you would say something, he would just crinkle up his nose in a way that displayed utter contempt for your kind of thinking, and you just dropped it. You didn't discuss it any further. Now that was such a powerful thing that sometimes even to this day when I'm working on an idea, even for a shiur, and it seems right, but I'm not 100% sure, in my mind I play over saying it to him, who's no longer alive, but in my mind I play over saying it to him and I watch his nose. And if his nose crinkles up, I discard the idea. I don't even think further. If it's not the kind of thing he would have approved of, I find the reasoning suspect, and I drop it and work on something else instead. That's the role of the father and the teacher. Not just to teach us what we're doing and to pass on information to us, but to inculcate into a child a sense of what we just don't do. Very, very important. I think that it doesn't happen in schools today at all. In fact, I know it doesn't happen in schools today. For a teacher to go out to a child and simply say, we don't do that. That just is something we don't do. And for children to get used to the idea that there are certain things that we don't do. This is what Yosef used as his mechanism to withhold himself from a passionate desire. And what's important in this discussion is on the one hand to realize the power of the passion, which is legitimate. The Torah doesn't criticize him for the passion. The Torah lauds him and praises him for being able to pay the price of withstanding that passion. When one finds that living a religious and a moral life is easy, one knows that one isn't living a religious and a moral life. Morality doesn't mean not having the passion for wrong. Morality means having an enormous passion for wrong and being able to hold it in check, being able to deal with it in a way that doesn't destroy the individual, but builds the individual. And Yosef had that. And for that event, he's called Yosef HaTzadik, the righteous Yosef. You might have thought he would have been even more righteous if he never went into the house. He would have been even more righteous if he never looked at the woman. No, that's not righteousness. Righteousness is he appreciated her beauty and craved for it. But when he saw his father's face, he just dropped all the rationalizations and said, this is not something we do. That's how he dealt with it. What about Palti? Palti is married a magnificent woman, Michal, destined for the king, and they're living together. Living together as husband and wife. As far as the public is concerned, they're husband and wife. They're intimate, they're alone together, they go out together, live together. Lamed we're taught, says the Medrash in the Yalkut, Shemu'atz cherev beno levono. Whenever they were together, Paltiel used to take a sword and put it between the two of them to remind himself, kol ha'osek b'dora zeh yibakeh b'cherev. But touching this woman is a capital offense. And he created something visual to show him that over time. He regarded her as still married to David. And although the king decreed that she should live with Paltiel, and he could do nothing about that, and they stayed together and lived together and worked together and operated together, but when it came to any intimacy, he had the visualization of a sword there to know, this is not allowed, this is not okay. That's the level of mechanism needed to cope with the energies and the powers of the human being and the morality of the Torah. It's not something that one can always justify and always explain away and always find a kosher way to do something which isn't right. There are some things kosher. He was married to her. There was a kosher wedding. There was a rabbi there, there were witnesses there, there was a glatt kosher reception, the whole Sanhedrin was present. But in his heart he knew it wasn't right. In his heart he knew this woman was emotionally married to David, and David was emotionally married to her. He knew that if he did have relations with her, she could never go back to David. And throughout their married life, he keeps the sword between them to remind himself that although society considers it okay, it's not okay for me. We don't do that kind of thing. That's the nobility of a Paltiel. And God adds his name to Paltiel and says, I give evidence that this man never touched her. If that's the case, the question is why he followed her crying all the way until Avner said, go home. What are you crying about? You should be delighted. Finally, you're delivering her back. And the Gemara says the most amazing thing. What is it that she was sad about? What is it that he was sad about? Why was he crying? Why was he mourning the loss of Michal? So the Gemara, he wasn't mourning the loss of Michal. This was a moment he knew would come inevitably. He protected her for this moment. He delighted in this moment. But it deprived him of a spiritual stature that he knew he would never have again. The spiritual stature of living every day with a passion that he wasn't fulfilling just because it was wrong. And that gave him height, that gave him elevation, that gave him spirituality. As we said in the case of Yosef, to do right because you don't have the passion for wrong, that's not righteousness. But each day that Paltiel desired this woman and looked at the sword and said no, God might say it's okay, society might say it's okay, the Sanhedrin might say it's okay, but I know it's wrong and I won't do it, that gave him enormous power. We raise ourselves not only from the good things we do, but even more so from the bad things we don't do. There is more greatness, there is more nobility, there is more spiritual elevation in the wrong things we don't do. Talking about what we desire to do, we're not talking about the wrong things one doesn't want to do, we're talking about the wrong things one wants to do but chooses not to do. Chooses not to do not because we don't want it or don't have a taste for it, choose not to do it simply because it's wrong. There's greater spirituality in that than all the good things that we do. That's why when the convert comes, the non-Jew comes to Hillel and says, teach me the whole Torah while standing on one leg, what does Hillel say? He does not say, love your neighbor as yourself. That's easy. Every nation can do that. Loving is easy. Doing things for people is easy. Becoming a hero is easy. Not doing things, not damaging, not hurting, not harming. For Yosef to understand that with all the religious justification, the fact is, if I had relations with this woman, I would be doing a disservice to Potiphar. For Palti to understand, although I'm married to this woman, technically, legally, religiously, if I were to have relations with her, I would be damaging David. To deny oneself something one craves passionately because of its capacity to harm and damage another person, that's where true spirituality is. That's what true elevation is. And that's the common denominator between Paltiel and Yosef in this particular episode. That leaves us with the third section that we need to delve into a little bit, and that is, what did Avner do wrong? Why was he killed? Why did God allow him to be killed? Was he a villain or was he a hero? That we're going to have to analyze in next week. And once again, I remind you that the refreshments will be at 8:30 and the shul will start at approximately 10 minutes before 9. There you go. That's good. Then I've done something tonight.
I had not heard that the law keeping someone from remarrying.